Sunshine Laws, Peregrine Falcons, and 1950s Cuba. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida Sunshine Laws make our state one of the most transparent in the union. That doesn't mean that politicians and local governments are always going to be cooperative. We're going to learn more about those laws and the upcoming First Amendment Foundation Sunshine Seminar this week in Broward. Plus, bird watchers take their hobby seriously. In the Florida Keys, October is especially important because it's the time for hawk mania and the arrival of the peregrine falcon. And we'll meet the creator and a couple of performers of a new show that takes us back to Cuba of the 1950s. All of that and an update on Hurricane Michael on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the Florida Panhandle is bracing itself for Hurricane Michael. Governor Rick Scott declared a state of emergency yesterday afternoon in 26 counties as the storm pounded western Cuba with heavy rainfall and strong winds. Gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum canceled a campaign event in Key West today to get back to Tallahassee. The impacts of the tropical storm, the hurricane winds and rain are already being felt across South Florida and the Keys. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network's Cindy O'Quinn joins us with an update on the storm. Cindy, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And I believe we do have her there. Cindy, you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
All right. Cindy, real quickly, what's the latest status on the hurricane? Where is it located right now?
Right now, the hurricane is located just along the western tip of Cuba. It was just upgraded with the 11 a.m. advisory to a hurricane. That now makes it the seventh hurricane of the 2018 season. Wind speed 75 miles per hour. It is continuing that northerly track at 7 miles per hour. But it is just about to enter into the Gulf of Mexico. And that's where we're going to see rapid strengthening because it is expected to become a Category 2 hurricane by this evening.
And where is it projected to make landfall in Florida?
Right now, the path is taking it north, and then it's going to get caught up in the trough and take sort of a northeasterly curve. Now, that's not going to have a direct impact on Miami, though you will definitely, as you're seeing now, some impacts. The storm is actually expected to head towards the Florida Panhandle and then make a northeasterly curve, pulling it near Apalachicola and the Big Bend.
So, yeah, what are we going to feel here in South Florida? I mean, already we've got a lot of rain, so far this morning, but what can we expect over the next 24 hours?
Well, over the next 24 hours, we do have the area of high pressure, which is on off to the east of you. We have this deepening strong low as a hurricane. And so what's going to be happening is this storm develops into a Cat 2 storm later on today and then into Tuesday afternoon late into a major category hurricane is you're going to have a very strong pressure gradient. And what that means for Miami is that's going to be increasing your easterly onshore flows. Even though you're not in the Gulf of Mexico, you're going to be seeing higher than normal tides because of that water being pushed on shore. Now, already, we're looking at the peak of the king tide, which occurs on October the 9th on Tuesday, and so we're looking at additional higher than normal. In fact, this will be the highest king tide of the year. So that's one of the main impacts we're going to see is that very strong onshore flow. You're actually not going to see the tropical storm force winds, but you will see the rainfall across, especially even the Keys, 2 to 4 inches, and then up in the Miami area could see about 2 inches in some areas.
Yeah, and how would that impact the king tides? I mean, are we talking about the king tides we were already expecting, and then
Correct.
This on top of that, so it just makes it worse?
Right. So you have a couple of different things that you're looking at with the king tides. Now, that's, of course, you're looking at that as with, the difference of the sun and the moon, the seasonal effects. But also, this is the normal annual high tides. But you're also looking at the impact of the increasing seas with that stronger onshore flow as the hurricane continues to strengthen. That's going to make those winds stronger coming in off the ocean of the Atlantic. And that's actually going to push a little bit more water on shore. So right now, we're already seeing and tides about 0.7 of a foot higher than they have been predicted already with the storm.
And what about the Keys? What are they going to be feeling, even starting now?
Well, they are starting to see some of the rain showers coming through. And as we get a little bit later into tonight, as that storm continues to strengthen, then they will have the chance to see some brush of the tropical storm force winds. But Miami is far enough to the east that we're not expecting that. But some of the Keys will see some of those tropical storm force winds as early as this evening, and then definitely as we get into the later hours towards early on Wednesday.
You know, it's still hurricane season, but what do we usually see around this time? Is this normal, or things are starting to die down, right?
Things are starting to die down, but we are still in that window. So any time between August the 20th to October the 10th, that puts us into the peak of hurricane season. And typically when we see two-thirds of all of our activity, so we are still well within that window of a day or two. But one thing that's sort of different this year is that the water temperatures are so warm in the Gulf of Mexico that that's why we're going to be seeing this rapid strengthening as the storm enters, because it's just a perfect scenario. And even though we've had a lot of wind shear with this one, it's still increasing. So that's why we've had such a concern with the storm that we've been watching. It's that disturbed area weather since last week.
And you know, it seems like, because I know at least two times during this season, this hurricane season, we've come out and reported that, you know, not predictions, but obviously the call for how many storms to expect this season kept changing because it hasn't been as busy a year as in past, correct?
No. Now, we had last year was an incredibly busy year with the 17 named storms, but before that, we had almost sort of a drought where there really wasn't a lot that went on for about 11 or 12 years. But now, this year, we had just slightly above normal predictions, and then when they had the update mid-season, a couple of things had changed. The water temperatures in some parts of the oceans were a little bit cooler, so they backed off of some of those predictions just a little bit. But then we have just had some incredibly warm temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico with that little run of storms that we were watching that cooled off the Atlantic, but they still had the warm waters. And this is really, this time of year, climatological speaking, the Gulf is one place you can see storms develop.
Cindy O'Quinn, again, meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, as we track Hurricane Michael. As she said, we're going to feel some of it out here, but not really a lot. Of course, we have the King Tides, so that plays a role. The Keys are going to feel an impact, but again, this is a storm that is threatening the Florida Panhandle. We'll keep track of Hurricane Michael over the next 48 hours and more. Cindy, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
All right, thank you.
All right, still to come, what do you know about Florida's open government laws? We get a refresher on our sunshine laws, all coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you know, Florida boasts having some of the most transparent government laws. Our sunshine laws clearly state that most activity done by our elected officials and local governments is accessible by its citizens. Now, what do you know about the sunshine laws and the access that you're allowed to have? We're joined now by the president of the First Amendment Foundation, Barbara Peterson. Barbara, great to have you back.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Also, I just want to mention that the First Amendment Foundation is going to be hosting events around the state around sunshine laws, including one at the Sun Sentinel this Wednesday, and it is open to the public. Barbara, let's start with this. Florida sunshine laws. Just remind us real quickly what those are.
Well, we have both a right of access to government meetings. That's commonly referred to as the Sunshine Law. That law says that any discussion of public business between two or more members of the same board or commission must be opened and noticed to the public unless there is a specific legal exception that would allow them to close the meeting.
Now,
our public records law, go ahead.
Uh-huh. No. Keep going.
Our public records law is very broad. Any document in any form, that's a text message, it could be a Facebook post, it could be an email, any record relating to public business, as a rule, must be provided to the public upon request. There will be some information in those records that might be deleted or redacted because of an exemption. But it's a very broad public records law also.
Yeah. Now, this series of these seminars that you're holding, and you have this one coming up at the Sun Sentinel again in Broward County on Wednesday. Who's going to be in attendance? What are these seminars about?
Well, the seminars are meant to inform people about the requirements, the rights, and the responsibilities under our open government laws. And our audience, we've been doing these since 1995. Our audience is generally made up of government officials. I wish more of them would come, elected and appointed public officials, government employees, members of the media, and citizens. So it's a pretty broad group, and we try to both cover the basics of the Sunshine Law and the Public Records Law, and then go into depth and answer more people's questions, specific questions about requests they've received or their attempts to attend a school board meeting. So it's pretty good in-depth seminar ranges. It lasts about 3 hours, and the cost is really reasonable too. So people get a really good understanding of the open government laws, the requirements of the laws from these seminars.
So, you know, what makes Florida's Sunshine Law interesting compared to and unique compared to other states?
Oh, it's one of the oldest. We have one of the oldest laws in the country. Our public records law was codified in 1909. Our open meetings law was enacted in 1968. And then we also are one of six states, only six states in the country, that have a specific constitutional right of access to the records and meetings of our government. So the constitutional right of access is pretty spectacular. And what is really important is in Florida, a custodian of public records can deny your public records request, or the school board can deny your participation in a school board meeting, only if they have specific statutory authority. Only the legislature can create exceptions to our law, which means there's no balancing of interests by local government or state government.
They have passed different rules, exceptions, even
a
recently. Yeah, let's look at some interesting Sunshine Law cases that are in play right now. And let's start with Parkland. The press, parents, others have asked for different information from the school district and from the sheriff on the Parkland shooting. According to the law, how much information are the citizens allowed to have access to in a case like that?
There's quite a bit, actually. Any investigations, investigative records into the shooting, to the shooter, to the people, the law enforcement officers and their reaction to the shooting. Investigative records, both internal investigations and criminal investigations, those records are exempt from disclosure, but only so long as the investigation is active. Once the investigation is closed, most of those records will become subject to public disclosure. There might be some information, again, that's exempt. One of the big issues right after the shooting was the reaction of law enforcement. There were allegations between law enforcement agencies that some did their jobs better than others. There was the allegation that the school resource officer had not engaged the shooter. And how do we make sense? How do we as the public make sense? Who's telling us the truth? And so a group of media organizations and other organizations, such as the First Amendment Foundation, went to court and asked for access to the external video, security video, that showed where the law enforcement officers were and when they, where they were and when they were there. This was objective evidence. That allowed us to say, okay, you need to be held accountable because you didn't respond appropriately. That's the point of our laws, to be able to oversee our government and hold it accountable.
Right.
And in that Parkland case where we were able to get the security video, I think sort of epitomizes the importance of access to government information.
And let me look at another case, this one up in Tallahassee. This one has to deal with the Tallahassee City Commission. They're hiring a new city manager. And so really briefly, just describe what's happening there, because, you know, any conversations about a public official that's going to be hired for a job has to be open, and any of those meetings have to be open. But what's happening right now in Tallahassee?
Well, what happened originally, the former city manager, Rick Fernandez, had to resign after he denied a public records request for text messages. He claimed he had no records. There were no records responsive to the request. He had asked a lobbyist for the city for some very expensive football tickets, which was a violation, potential violation of ethics. But then got caught flat-footed when a reporter had requested the text messages. He said he didn't have any, and the reporter was able to get those text messages from another source, showing that the city manager had lied about this interaction. Those text messages were public record. So he resigned, and now the city is hiring a replacement. The Sunshine Law, the open meetings law, applies to any interviews of candidates if the city commission has to approve their hiring. In other words, if the city manager could hire a part-time clerk and didn't have to seek city commission approval, Sunshine Law wouldn't apply.
And real quickly, there's something interesting here, because you talk about text messages, and I wondered, how does the Sunshine Law apply to text messages or email that are being sent on a private email, not a work email?
Well, that's what happened in Mr. Fernandez's case. If it meets the definition of a public record, in other words, it relates to public business, it is a public record subject to disclosure. The law does not prohibit public officials or government employees from using personal communication devices to communicate about public business. But even if it's sent from a private email account or your personal communication device, you're using your personal cell phone number to text, if it's a public record, it must be retained and maintained according to law, and you must provide access to it.
Yeah.
So it really doesn't matter. It's just sometimes harder for us to get those records. Right? Because most people will make a public records request for all records sent or received on your .gov email account. I always make my request very broadly, all public record emails or all public record texts, regardless of whether they were sent or received on a personal communication device.
We're talking with Barbara Peterson, president of the First Amendment Foundation. She's joining us via Skype. The First Amendment Foundation is hosting a number of Sunshine Law events, including this Wednesday at the Sun Sentinel. The derisive 2018 event with Dave Barry and Carl Hyacin is tomorrow night, and we'll also dive into issues of government transparency. Again, that is open to the public. There is an entry fee, but again, open to the public. You know, one of the interesting things, Barbara, too, is about when it comes to getting public records, when you put in a request for those records, that there likely going to be fees involved in trying to get that information. What does the law say about how much you could be charged for those documents?
Well, unfortunately, the fee provision, there are two fee provisions under the public records law. One is for the cost of copying. That's not the problem for the most part. The problem is the second one, the extensive use provision that gives a great deal of latitude, too much latitude to my way of thinking, to the agency in determining how much they are going to charge you to obtain copies of the records you've requested. The extensive use fee allows an agency to charge for personnel time. And I have seen fees just this week. A woman contacted me. She was trying to get emails. I think it was going to cost her, if I'm not mistaken, just over $2,000 to get access to roughly 5,000 emails. They were charging her for the cost of reading each email to ensure that there was no exempt information in it. A reporter I talked to this past week was having very similar problems, although the cost was much higher. The woman was being charged $19.95 an hour for the personnel, the person to look at the records. The reporter was being charged $79.95 for the same type of review, reading emails. So there's a lot of disparity. The fees can be outrageous. And the law says that the extensive use fee must be reasonable and must be based on actual costs incurred.
And so, yeah, you say reasonable. I've heard different stories, too, about, you know, just trying to get a hold of documents or emails that could cost thousands of dollars. It almost seems, I'm just making this observation, it almost seems like it's just a way people are trying to find to not get you information because if they put it out of reach. But how do they determine that? How do they determine how much they should charge for how long I'm going to have my clerk look through emails?
Well, that's the problem. So, yes, you're absolutely right. In some cases, they just don't want you to have them. There was a reporter I was working with in Southeast Florida. He got a bill for $3.5 million.
What?
For access. That's the most extreme. $3.5 million. And it was going to take the agency 7 years to fill the public records request. This was email correspondence. I think that's one problem. That's more rare, however, that they just don't want you to have it. Sometimes they just don't want to be bothered. But the bigger problem is they're not using sort of common sense. They're not doing a particularly good job of storing their email. You know, when things were in paper, everything was in a file cabinet. You'd have a file that said correspondence 2016 to 2017. You'd open that drawer and there's your correspondence. Now, when everything's electronic, I don't know that agencies are doing such a good job of filing, for one thing. Everybody emails all the time. So there's a lot more correspondence than there used to be. And they're not using readily available technology software that help them archive and store and retrieve public records and in electronic formats and even redact exempt information automatically. They're not using those because there's no incentive so long as they can pass the costs along to us.
Again, talking with Barbara Peterson, president of the First Amendment Foundation, joining us via Skype. The First Amendment Foundation hosting a number of Sunshine Law events, including this Wednesday at the Sun Sentinel. And as you heard, we've been playing the piece throughout the weekend. The Derisive 2018 event is with Dave Barry and Carl Hyacin. That's tomorrow night. We'll have information up on our website, WLRN.org. Barbara Peterson, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much for enlightening us on the fact that our state does have such open laws.
Thank you very much, and I'd encourage everyone to go to Derision 2018 Tuesday night and then our Sunshine Seminar on Wednesday morning.
Fantastic. Barbara, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And just a reminder, if you have not joined our Sundial Book Club, go to our Facebook group and ask to join. Just look up Sundial Book Club. This month, we're reading Veins of the Ocean by Patricia Engel. Tomorrow on Sundial, we're going to hear a conversation we had with her recently about the book and about the immigrant experience. Well, coming up next, October marks the migration of thousands of falcons to the Florida Keys. We're going to learn about hawk mania coming up this weekend. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. So what's the fastest bird in the world? It can reach top speeds close to 240 miles per hour when diving. If you guessed peregrine falcon, you would be correct. October marks a key time for the migration of the peregrine falcon. The Florida Keys is an essential stopping point on the bird's migration south to Cuba and eventually South America. This weekend in Florida Keys, the Florida Keys Audubon Society will host the fourth annual Hawk Mania event, where visitors will have the opportunity to watch the migration in action and learn more about the falcon. The Florida Keys Audubon Society Executive Director Mark Hedden joins us now from the studios of Key West. Mark, such a pleasure, man. Welcome.
How you doing, Lewis?
Doing great. And then also, joining us here in studio in downtown is Rafael Galvez, the director of the Florida Keys Hawk Watch Migration Project. Rafael, thank you so much for joining us, man. Appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having us.
All right, so both of you, I'm just curious, what makes the peregrine falcon such a unique species of bird, besides the fact that it is super incredibly fast? Mark?
Well, it's actually not just the fastest bird in the world. It's the fastest animal. Like, if you threw a jaguar off the Empire State Building, a peregrine would be faster. It really would.
Oh, my God. All right. That's an interesting visual, too.
I'm not suggesting anyone should throw jaguars. It's just a bad idea. But, I mean, the peregrine is just an incredibly fast bird, but it's also just a beautiful bird, and it has an amazing story about, you know, its migration and its habitat and the way it lives.
I know bird watchers. I mean, they take it very seriously. But what is it about the falcon and, you know, when it's coming through the Keys at this time of year that it attracts so many bird watchers? What is so special about it?
Mark. Rafael, you want that?
Yeah. No, go ahead, Mark. I mean, I want to hear both of you. But
I mean, part of it is the mystery of this thing is they were almost wiped out in the United States in the 70s due to DDT. So, you know, you didn't see peregrine falcons like this in the 80s. And then at some point, people clued in on the migration going through the Keys. It was kind of like in the late 80s, early 90s. And then they started doing counts, and we've been able to see the numbers of the species come back. And this is a bird that, you know, will breed in Greenland and then migrate to Tierra del Fuego just kind of for fun.
Yeah.
Well, not for fun, but, you know, for life.
Right. No, I gotcha. And Rafael, I mean, your take on what is so unique about this time of year, this opportunity to see this bird as that's amazing that it is going all the way down into South America. But what's unique about this?
It's beautiful to watch all these birds passing through. It's like a river of birds all going away from our continent towards destinations unknown. And it touches our hearts in a way that sort of mirrors our own migrations. We've all come from somewhere else, and we may all be going to yet different destinations unknown. And these birds, when you're sitting out there by the beach and watching them passing by, I'm an immigrant. I came from Peru, and some of these peregrine falcons will fly over the place of my birth, and maybe my brother that's down there by the beach will get to see him.
And this is, I mean, as you said, this is very special for you because it does, it represents so much to you in your life. It's this migratory bird that's just, it's got homes in a lot of places.
That's right. And it reminds us that we are, in the end, citizens of the world. And we tend to want to think, well, these are our birds. The eagle or this hawk is an American species, but in reality, the peregrine falcons that fly over the Florida Keys will fly over every country in Latin America and the Caribbean, every single country.
Mark, why the Florida Keys? Why is that a stop? Why not anywhere else in Florida or just go straight to Cuba? Why is that a special place?
Well, the really simple version of it is, you know, it's risky for a bird of prey, a falcon, a hawk, any of those birds to fly over water. They can't swim, and they largely move by kind of riding up on thermals like an elevator and then gliding as long as possible. But thermals don't exist over water, so they're trying to get as close to Cuba as possible before they have to make that powered flight. So we're kind of like a ramp. So, you know, it starts kind of just below Marathon in the Keys. It starts to be about the same distance to Cuba from all those places, and they start peeling out. But we still get a goodly number of them in Key West every year. And so it's that proximity to, you know, it's the shortest leap to the Caribbean and point south.
All right, good. It's good to know that humans aren't the only ones who have to do connecting flights. You know, always a pit stop somewhere if you have to. You know what, Rafael, where are the best places to watch? What are you telling people about where to go?
Sure. We have one site that we have been using for the monitoring of all birds of prey and really all migratory bird species in the Middle Keys at Curry Hammock State Park. And that site, the area around that site, has been used by the science community and citizen scientists and professional and amateur hawk watchers since the 80s. So we have a standardized project there at Curry Hammock State Park since 1999, and we're there every single day, rain or shine, 9 to 4 p.m. It's open to the public, and folks are welcome to come. But the difference with this weekend is that we're trying to light up different events from Miami through Marathon to Key West, and in a sense have folks migrate with us to Key West and listen to some experts talk about raptor migration, come and see it firsthand, go follow them to the Keys, and then do, finally, a Women's Appreciation Day that we'll be doing on the 14th at Curry Hammock State Park.
And by the way, you mentioned, and Mark said it too, raptor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, explain what the raptor is, and I guess what species the falcon's in.
Sure. The raptor is a general term that we use for all birds of prey, diurnal and nocturnal. So whether it's owls or hawks, eagles, falcons are actually not related to eagles. They're actually more closely related to parrots. But so we use these terms as a blanket to encompass all of the species that we monitor.
I didn't think of that. I didn't know that. That is such a strange combination. You know what, Mark? We have a hurricane right now coming up into the Gulf of Mexico, and I'm wondering, you know, how this storm might impact their migration.
Well, what it tends to do is it tends to slow it down. I mean, it's almost like bad weather when you're traveling. I mean, the birds just kind of land and kind of ride it out is what's going on now. I mean, once in a while you'll get a rare bird kind of blown up from the Caribbean, but not as often as people think. But yeah, so they're basically traveling. They hit bad weather and they kind of like hang out in the Keys like a lot of people.
Just wait it out.
Just kind of wait it out.
Just wait and see what happens. Rafael, the Hurricane Irma last year, what impact did it have on the migration? Because it was a little bit before the October, but I mean, did it impact the migrations? Did it impact how many you saw?
Well, we start counting September 1st, and we bring down expert counters from throughout the country and from throughout the Caribbean. It's not easy to identify birds on the wing. It takes a special set of skills. So these are coveted positions, and people want to come down and be part of our team. We had been 1 week into counting, and we had to be evacuated because of Hurricane Irma. And so much logistics and coordination comes into play with our state parks, with our housing facilities. The birds will continue coming through. Anyone that's been looking at birds for a long time will tell you that immediately after Hurricane Irma, in downed trees, he would see songbirds foraging. I mean, these birds have to continue going. They have to leave the Northern Hemisphere. So we were unable to continue our research last year, unfortunately. But we're back.
I'm talking with Rafael Galvez, the director of the Florida Keys Hawkwatch Migration Project, also Mark Hedden of the Florida Keys Audubon Society. This weekend, the Florida Keys Audubon Society is hosting its fourth annual Hawk Mania event. Visitors will learn about and, of course, witness the thousands of peregrine falcons that are crossing the Florida Keys en route to eventually South America. Mark, real quickly, the peregrine used to be a threatened species. What's mm-hmm. the status right now?
I think it's down to threatened right now. And it's still under federal protection under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. But it has, I mean, the numbers have come back pretty well, partly through a captive breeding program and partly because of, you know, eliminating DDT from the ecosystem.
And so, you know, I mean, in the last few years of this event, I mean, typically, what do you see? How many are you going to see come through?
Well, in Key West, you get into a tricky situation because they hit Key West and, like a lot of people, they just kind of hang around for a while. The numbers are better out of Marathon, but we'll see probably, you know, 200 in a day, sometimes 100 in a day.
Hmm.
It all depends. And then there's, you know, there's another dozen species of raptors we also see migrating.
And just,
so it's also pretty cool.
Do you get to see them when they're, I saw the National Geographic videos when they're doing their dive and just, mm-hmm. I saw when they attacked a pigeon and I was like, oh my God, it's amazing to watch. But do you get to see them in the hunt as well?
We were doing it 2 years ago and there were seven different peregrine falcons fighting over the same bird that they were all trying to eat. And, you know, and they were basically harassing each other till one of them dropped it and then another one would come in and grab it. And it was kind of like, I forget that game you played as a kid where one person gets the football and runs around, but it was kind of like that. And, you know, it was dogpiling, essentially, and they were just kind of, you know, chasing each other around until they dropped it. So you get to see that. And, I mean, you're talking about National Geographic videos, and part of this is, for me, it's like when I grew up, it was kind of like something you saw in National Geographic, And when I realized I live in the Keys and I could just basically in September and October walk outside, I mean, last night I was emptying my trash can of like yard waste and I looked up and there was a peregrine flying over my house.
Oh.
The fact that they're just so proximate and available just makes me want to like grab people by the shirt collars and point them out to them.
That's a peregrine falcon. Look up already. Yeah. You know, Raphael, for people who are not, they're not birders. They haven't done this, but there's an interest. It's like, yeah, I'm going to go check it out. I mean, how does a person get started? What would you suggest to them how they could begin?
First thing, just come and join us. I really think that this is not really an event for birders per se. Birders tend to have shorter attention spans. They want to see multiple species and chase after different species. Not all of them, but many do. This is more of a sit back, relax, and witness one of nature's most amazing spectacles. Just if you have a pair of binoculars, all the better. They don't have to be super expensive or amazing, but we will have lots of binoculars at our events, so you don't even have to show up with that.
Oh.
And you can just sit back, look up, and just watch these beautiful creatures fly by. That's really what it's all about. Bring your family. Kids love this stuff.
It is. No, listen, again, just watching the videos is a lot of fun. I can only imagine seeing it up close must be a blast. And as Raphael said, they're going to bring binoculars in case if you don't have a pair of your own. And again, that is for this event that's coming up for Hawkmania. I just love that name itself. For the 4th annual Hawkmania, we're going to have photos and information on our website, WLRN.org. So if you want to check it out, Mark Hedden, again, of the Florida Keys Audubon Society, and Raphael Gavez, the director of the Florida Keys Hawkwatch Migration Project. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Lewis.
Thank you so much for having us.
And a lot of fun. And by the way, if you do go to this, please share your photos, share your experience with us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. We'd like to hear. By the way, don't forget, you can always go back and listen to any of our old programs at WLRN.org. Better yet, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and also find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial so you can keep up with the latest news on the program. So coming up, let's take a trip back to Havana in the 1950s. A new musical comes to us in Coral Gables. It brings that history to life. All next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the politics of life in Cuba in the 1950s is at the center of a new show called Havana Music Hall, Playing in Coral Gables. It follows the story of a musical duo, husband and wife, Rolando and Ramona Calderon, who are close to getting a big break, and they hit the world stage. And then Fidel Castro shows up. Now, the play touches on the Cuban immigrant experience through the power of survival, love, and music. Havana Music Hall will be at the Actors Playhouse at the Miracle Theater in Coral Gables, October 10th through November 18th. Joining me now in studio is Richard Kagan. He is the creator, composer, and lyricist of the Havana Music Hall. Richard, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
And also joining us in studio is Elaine Flores, who plays Maria and Bruno. I had this.
And we'll call you.
No.
We'll call you. Your audition isn't going so great.
I'm glad I'm trying out.
Bruno Faria.
Thank you, Bruno. I appreciate that. And he plays Alberto. Yes, I knew that was going to happen to me. All right. Richard, real quickly, take us back to Cuba in the 1950s, really where the show's setting starts.
It was a time where music was everything, and people came from all over the world to hear these great musicians and see these spectaculars that were like at the Club Tropicana, and it's what Vegas always hoped it to be. And it was just a little naughty, and people would go there, but we'd have Nat King Cole, and you'd have Sinatra, and you'd have the Mafia, but you also would have princes and kings, and it was a very exciting time to visit Cuba.
So where did the idea for this show come from?
Well, frankly, it was Buena Vista Social Club. When I saw that musical, I just couldn't believe those great musicians who lost everything and were shining shoes, but they had this amazing talent. And that's where I really wanted to do the musical, Buena Vista Social Club. So I called Roy Cooter, who was the guy who did the documentary, and he said that he was done because it was very hard to find those kinds of musicians. Young people are into hip-hop and not into that. And then the music was public domain, but they wanted to sell me the rights to the name but have artistic control. So my wife, I'm married to Julie Haggerty from Airplane, if you know, and she said, why don't you just write Dream Girls, you know, which is like the story of the Supremes, but they didn't have the right. Why don't you do your own? So I called it Havana Music Hall. I came up with this idea that there was an after-hours club, but I had no idea. And then I saw a movie called Chef. I met Perico Hernandez, who played the father of Sofia Vergara. He told me his story. He said, if you help me tell my story, I will help you. And that's how this all came about.
All right. Elaine and Bruno, you play Maria and Alberto. This is the sister-in-law and brother of Rolando and Ramona. Real briefly, tell me, who is Maria? Who's Alberto?
So Maria, wife of Alberto, she is a realist. She is supporting her husband's dream. He sings in a band, and he wants to play at the Tropicana, which is very, very famous in Cuba, and they want to go worldwide. And while I support him, I'm also a realist, and I'm scared about the new change in government. So in the song that we're going to sing, he comes home all excited about this news that he's going to sing at Tropicana, and I am excited but also scared.
And Bruno, tell us a little bit about Alberto.
Oh, Alberto is this laid-back, super chill, cool guy. You know, he's the Spanish Dean Martin. You know, he's not stressed about Fidel or whoever. You know, he's like, it's Ben Batista, it's Ben Machado. Fidel is just going to be another guy coming in, and he's going to be out soon. Like, don't stress. Everything is going to be okay. We're going to be famous. I'm playing at the Tropicana. Little does he know, you know, the whole world comes crumbling down. And, you know, it's not as, you know, as he thought it would be.
This is interesting. So, you're from here in South Florida. Right?
I'm from Brazil.
No, you're from Brazil, but you went to school here, right?
Yeah, I went. I graduated FAU.
FAU, that's right. So you trained here in
yes.
South Florida.
Well, I've been doing theater here in South Florida.
What I'm getting at is that you've been in South Florida long enough. You know that story. You know the Cuban American story because you've heard of it.
Not only is it Cuban America, I think a lot of South American people in general and Latinos, like, we in one way or another have lived through this.
Right.
Story, you know?
Yeah. And Elaine, that's the other thing, too, is like, you know, with your background, you know this story really, really well.
I definitely do. My grandparents migrated from Cuba in 1966. And in fact, they came over to Miami, and we have a line in the show that's just like this. And they said, this is temporary. There's a line in the show that somebody says that. They said that, and they never wanted to learn English. The 50 years that they were here in Miami, they said, we're going back.
How did both of your experiences, you know, kind of just help you in these roles? How did it shape the way you approached this?
Well, I definitely used my family's history, especially my grandmother, the way she always talked about the same stories of the government coming in. The government walked into their home one day, taped everything, took inventory, and said, this no longer belongs to you. And the way she would tell me that with, you know, tears in her eyes for however many years, I have to use that because there are scenes like this in our play. And, you know, I channel her energy, and I understand my family more than ever now.
Bruno, this song that you guys are going to perform a little bit for us here, lead us into it real quickly. What is this song about?
So.
And it's called My Husband and Wife.
Yes. So Alberto's pretty much, you know, very excited. You know, he feels like his dreams is coming true. But now, like every Hispanic and Latin man, they got to convince their wife first. You know what I mean? It's just like, babe, I want to do this and this and this and that. Are you on board? You know, like, so this is his, you know, his way of trying to smooth up to her and be like, you know, it's going to be okay. And she's like, no, nothing's going to be okay. Look what's going to happen. He's like, it's going to be all right, but we're going to be famous. You know, I'm going to buy you that Gucci bag you wanted, you know? And so everything is, you know, really chill with him. Whereas with her, she's trying to do the contrary. And it's pretty much a song trying to convince, you know, look at my point of view, look at my point of view. And it's just your typical Latin argument that's realistic, but also very comedic as well.
Well, let's get a taste of it. I'll go ahead and step aside. Go for it.
Our ship is not coming in, it's leaving. We better get on it before it's too late. Our world is about to change as we know it, and we won't be able to escape.
Doesn't have a clue.
¿Cómo que yo no tengo un clue?
My
husband doesn't know what to do.
Que yo no sé qué, what? This is where we belong.
Chico, no, it's not. what happens if you are wrong? Mi esposo,
mi mujer.
That was absolutely lovely. That is Elaine Flores and Bruno Faria, and they are both, they're playing Alberto. And I'm sorry, Elaine, your character is Maria. And in this new show, again, Havana Music Hall, which is playing in Coral Gables, and it opens October 10th. Richard, you know, I wanted to get a sense because, I mean, look, you know, living here in South Florida, you know, we've heard that story of the Cuban immigrant and how the revolution changed so many people's lives. But what about, what did it do to musicians and artists? You know, because they're telling us about their characters' attitudes to the revolution and what it might or might not mean for their careers. But what, from you, what, in your background research, you know, what did it do to the artists and the musicians of Cuba?
It was devastating. They had this dream to be what they want to be. And all of a sudden it was taken away. And I think it is a universal story. We're finding out that people from all over the world are, it's resonating with them, from Russia, from Syria, from Iran. You know, somebody said to me, you know, this is your story too, because when I was 18 years old, I wrote music with Marvin Hamlisch. He was my best friend, but when I heard him play the piano, I went in the insurance business. So for 50 years, I've been in the insurance business, and all of a sudden now, I've done this musical. So in a way, was my dream cut short? I'm not sure.
Now, and one real quickly, one other interesting aspect of the show is that it spans decades.
That's correct.
What can people expect when they go see it?
There's four things in a musical that I've learned because I've been involved in musicals. For me, you have to walk out humming, and I believe people are going to hum these songs. Secondly, you have to move. We have Maria Torres from On Your Feet. She did the choreography. She's Puerto Rican. She's from Dominican Republic and Cuba. We have a great story. People are interested in Cuba. But most importantly, it's resonating. You have to walk out of that theater feeling, my God, I learned something, or I feel a part of this. That's why Come From Away in New York is so successful. You, people walk out feeling, oh my God, there is a humanity. And I think that's what you're going to get from our show.
And again, the show is playing at the Actors Playhouse at the Miracle Theater in Coral Gables, October 10th through November 18th. Again, it's called Havana Music Hall. Richard Kagan is the creator, composer, and lyricist of the show. Elaine Flores plays Maria and Bruno Faria. Did I say that right?
You'll get it. It's Faria. But, you know, our next radio interview, you have it down packed. I believe you.
Bruno, you had me at the singing, so I love Bruno Faria. And folks, thank you so much. I really appreciate, and thank you so much for the song. That was really absolutely beautiful.
Thank you for having us.
Looking forward to the show, Break a Leg.
Thank you so much.
And again, we're going to have more information on this show on our website. Just go to WLRN Sundial on Facebook or WLRN.org to find out more. Again, October 10th through November 18th. Well, that's the program for today, this Monday, October 8th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.